It's hard to find the time to read all of the best articles on Bitcoin and the crypto economy. So let me read them for you. This is a Crypto Economy Quick Read. Quick Read 300. Guys, that is a huge milestone. I am so excited to be here. It feels pretty incredible to think that we have covered that much work on this show. And honestly, I mean, this is the crypto economy, and I am the guy who's read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And I have to say, that really is only true because of you guys. I actually do mean that honestly. If this show had ever been stagnant, if this wasn't continuing to grow and I didn't have consistent listeners who found value in what I was doing, I would be reading one-tenth what I have read in the last year and a half about Bitcoin. And so really the only way I can make that boast, the only reason I can make that boast is because this show has kept me motivated and kept me focused on being exactly that person. The guy who's read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. So, in honor of episode 300, I wanted to take it back to the roots a little bit. Hit one that should have been in my lineup already. One of those essential philosophical pieces, the ones that set, that encompasses the mindset of all the people who led us here for the 20 and 30 years leading up to Bitcoin, why it was created and who created it. And that is the Crypto Anarchist Manifesto by Timothy C. May. Cypherpunks of the World. Several of you at the, quote, physical cypherpunks gathering yesterday in Silicon Valley requested that more of the material passed out in meetings be available electronically to the entire readership of the cypherpunks list, spooks, eavesdroppers, and all. Here is the Crypto Anarchist Manifesto I read at the September 1992 founding meeting. It dates back to mid-1988 and was distributed to some like-minded techno-anarchists at the Crypto 88 conference, and then again at the Hackers conference that year. I later gave talks at Hackers on this in 1989 and 1990. There are a few things I'd change, but for historical reasons, I'll just leave it as is. Some of the terms may be unfamiliar to you. I hope the crypto glossary I just distributed will help. This should explain all those cryptic terms in my signature. Signed, Tim May. The Crypto Anarchist Manifesto. A specter is haunting the modern world. The specter of crypto anarchy. Computer technology is on the verge of providing the ability for individuals and groups to communicate and interact with each other in a totally anonymous manner. Two persons may exchange messages, conduct business, and negotiate electronic contracts without ever knowing the true name or legal identity of the other. Interactions over networks will be untraceable via extensive rerouting of encrypted packets and tamper-proof boxes which implement cryptographic protocols with nearly perfect assurance against any tampering. Reputations will be of central importance, far more important in dealings than even the credit ratings of today. These developments will alter completely the nature of government regulation, the ability to tax and control economic interactions, the ability to keep information secret, and will even alter the nature of trust and reputation. The technology for this revolution, and it surely will be both a social and economic revolution, has existed in theory for the past decade. The methods are based upon public key encryption, zero-knowledge interactive proof systems, and various software protocols for interaction, authentication, and verification. The focus has until now been on academic conferences in Europe and the US, conferences monitored closely by the National Security Agency. But only recently have computer networks and personal computers attained sufficient speed to make the ideas practically realizable. And the next 10 years will bring enough additional speed to make the ideas economically feasible and essentially unstoppable. High-speed networks, ISDN, tamper-proof boxes, smart cards, satellites, Q-band transmitters, multi-MIPS personal computers, and encryption chips now under development will be some of the enabling technologies. The state will, of course, try to slow or halt the spread of this technology, citing national security concerns, use of technology by drug dealers and tax evaders, and fears of societal disintegration. Many of these concerns will be valid. Crypto anarchy will allow national secrets to be traded freely and will allow illicit and stolen materials to be traded. An anonymous computerized market will even make possible abhorrent markets for assassinations and extortion. Various criminal and foreign elements will be active users of CryptoNet. But this will not halt the spread of crypto anarchy. Just as the technology of printing altered and reduced the power of medieval guilds and the social power structure, so too will cryptologic methods fundamentally alter the nature of corporations and of government interference in economic transactions. Combined with emerging information markets, crypto anarchy will create a liquid market for any and all material which can be put into words and pictures. And just as a seemingly minor invention, like barbed wire, made possible the fencing off of vast ranches and farms, thus altering forever the concepts of land and property rights in the frontier West, so too will the seemingly minor discovery out of an arcane branch of mathematics come to be the wire clippers which dismantle the barbed wire around intellectual property. Arise, you have nothing to lose but your barbed wire fences. Let's hit our sponsor real quick, and then we are going to do some digging into this piece. The Crypto Anarchist Manifesto by Timothy C. May. Timothy May actually died last year. There's a number of great videos on YouTube that you can watch. He has so many great just talks and discussions about so many things. The guy had a brain that just soaked up and just could digest ideas in a way that most people couldn't. And he's really the father of the whole crypto-anarchist idea. That started really back in, really the mid to late 80s. I mean, maybe really when this came about that it really landed. And he was one of the first people in the whole cyberpunk space. Which was really small. If you read about its origins, it's crazy how small of a group it actually was in Silicon Valley or whatever that they had meetings at. Like, I mean, just like he mentions towards the beginning of this, that they had their physical space meeting. They would literally meet at like a house. I can't remember whose it was, but it was like somebody in the group. I almost want to argue that it might have been Tim May's, but I'm probably wrong about that. But he was essential to the space early on, without a doubt. And he actually also has this, he's famous for, there was this issue. He worked at, I think it was Intel. It was one of the main chip manufacturers. I guess it was Intel. Intel's the only one I can think of. There was this really fascinating, problem that they were having with their chips where, data would get changed and corrupted like during the process, and nobody could figure out what it was. And he actually was the one that figured out that it was something to do with like radiation, like beta particles or alpha particles or something. And it was because they found out that it was because they had a ceramic housing, but basically the chips were getting so dense, the circuitry and well, not really the circuitry, but the transistors, the little pockets where they would hold a charge to decide whether or not there was a zero or one, were getting so tiny because of technology that extremely small amounts of radiation could actually affect the data, that it would actually interrupt a process, and that there was like this ceramic housing that they had on their chips that apparently was putting off just this tiny, tiny amount of radiation, but it was like straight up like on the chip. So it was producing it, and they had no idea. I mean, think about it. These are a bunch of software engineers trying to figure out why their software isn't working, why the processor is not doing what they think it should do. And, you know, it's not like you can look inside these things. Like, it was getting to the point where you were having to have a computer, because only a computer could make things as tiny as the chips that were needed to build the computer. And that's where we're in this place, actually, where technology is so dense now that we can't really look inside of it. We don't really know what's going on. We can only actually make any sense of it because we have the computers to abstract away what's actually going on. Like, we've lost the ability to actually look and understand what's happening inside of a chip outside of a computer doing the billions and trillions of calculations and organizations that we tell it to do. Like, we give it these broad instructions, and the computer is what actually, you know, makes every single like transistor and individual pocket of that chip do what it needs to do. So it's really crazy that we've like reached this abstraction level where it's only because of a higher level computer working toward a lower level computer working toward a lower level computer to make the chip that we can actually continue. Like, we already have this sort of like computer dependent economy. But regardless, it's totally beside the point. Was that Tim actually realized, like he kind of took a step back and, you know, looked at the actual hardware and what was actually going on, and sourced out this crazy problem that nobody could make sense of, and was like, yeah, I think we've reached a point where like we may have like some alpha particles or whatever actually interrupting our processes. And sure enough, that was it. And they got rid of the ceramic housing that was essentially allowing or creating this problem, and moved to something else. I can't remember what it was, but it was a fascinating story. I read it in, actually, I may have heard it in a talk by Tim May, now that I think about it. I don't know. I'm not going to be able to recommend which one that is because I don't remember. But this piece for read number 300, I just thought this was a perfect one to cover. And the first thing to note here is just how long ago this was. And I love thinking about how much the world has changed in that time, particularly when it may not seem like that vision has become a reality. At least not yet. I think we have pushed heavily in that direction, and I think it is still on the horizon. And I really do think he's right. I think the cypherpunks and the crypto anarchist movement really saw something that most people weren't. They were seeing, most people can't see outside of the current structure of the system, because it's, the system depends on, and I hate sounding like, oh, the system, but literally the people in participating in some sort of societal structure, that structure depends on people believing and understanding in the validity of that structure. So the ability to look outside of it is incredibly rare, because just the notion of looking outside of it is to suggest that the one we're already a part of is wrong, which is why you have these massive changes in society, like the Industrial Revolution, the printing press, and nobody sees the transition while it's happening. That we just miss, that the whole world just flipped upside down and everybody's holding on for dear life and then pretending that, you know, nothing's changing. And I really think that's where we are. Most people don't see that things are changing at an unprecedented rate. And this piece was originally presented in 1988, he says at the beginning. And then he talks about in 10 years, it would be economically feasible. That they now have the tools and the technology, but it would be economically feasible to have standard encryption available to anybody with a computer. And what he saw as a possibility with this technology cannot be understated. And we could argue that it's taken much longer for this vision to become a reality. And I would say that really now it's truly beginning to take shape. I think Bitcoin was a critical missing piece to the foundation of Timothy's vision when he wrote this. But that over the next 20 years following this piece, the attempt to make Bitcoin took a ton of different forms and the solving of multiple different problems. I'm just in the precursors to it. We've got B-Money, DigiCash, Hashcash, BitGold, and other a number of other proposals that either were attempted implementations or just proposals that never really got off the ground. But they were all attempting to do that thing of creating a natively digital currency. And while those precursors didn't succeed, none of them lasted, they did lay the groundwork that made Bitcoin possible and set that seed into the cypherpunk movement and the cryptography communities that this was a solvable problem and we should continue to devote time and resources to it, that it was an important problem. And if you've listened to the Cypherpunk Manifesto, you know their whole goal was about privacy and independence, and how critical that was to maintain that, because it is something that we can and arguably have very much lost in the information age. And I think we're getting it back. I think that pressure is swinging back in the opposite direction. And because the technology and the tools are now so cheap and so ubiquitous that we essentially have the excess and the pressure with enough important things online now to make people realize or at least begin to recognize the cost of losing all of that privacy, where it was just kind of absent-minded at first. I've mentioned a couple times in previous conversations and on the show that in meat space, in the real world, privacy is by default. It's unless we let you in, you know, I can just go into my room and then boom, I'm private. Nobody's like looking at me. But in the digital space, it's the exact opposite. This whole thing has flipped on its head. And rather than asking why should you be invading my privacy, suddenly privacy is just non-existent unless we work really hard to get it back. And the question immediately becomes, well, why do you want your privacy? So it's flipped the whole principle on its head into what I believe is an immoral space, that we have the right to privacy and I don't have to explain anything. I don't have to tell you any reason at all why I want to close the door while I'm taking a shit. Like, it's none of your business. And I think it's important that we turn that back around, and I think we have the technology to do that, but it has to be done at the foundational layer. What Tim May was talking about here was an alternative economy, a crypto economy, if you will. That's what this show is about. That's what I mean by the term crypto economy, a global, open, cryptographically secured marketplace, essentially. Not just a single marketplace, but a cohesive set of standards that create a global market, a means of creating and sustaining agreements between people we don't know, between people we do not necessarily have to do business with, but that we can secure agreements and establish a safe exchange between each other. And I think while encryption is a true building block to that vision, that the real foundation of the world that he envisioned was in fact an independent digital currency. Without that, there's no way to actually create an independent economy. Instead, if we've still got the state-controlled money at its foundation, all we can do is kind of create like a privacy branch or maybe an independent branch at the edges of the core of the state-controlled economy. We are still at the whim of the political nature of money. So as long as the reins of money are left in the hands of a centralized power, the economy born from that will always remain systemically attached to the political apparatus. It will still feel the imbalances. It will still have to, you know, if you shake the trunk of the tree, it doesn't matter what you really do on your branches, the branches are going to shake too. And that's what we had if we're trying to get back privacy on the internet and trying to build a private economy or alternative economy, but we're trying to do it with state-run money. There's no way to avoid the fact that the economy will shake when the state fucks with the trunk of the tree. And they do. That's like, that's their favorite thing to do, is just screw with the money. That's their whole game. It's just, you know, we've got a hammer and everything is a nail. So we actually did see many of the things that Tim May discussed in this come to fruition, even before the birth of Bitcoin. And it seems to have been, it seems to have accelerated to a degree that's really hard to understate. Now, there is an argument to be made that most of the internet has actually led to the exact opposite. The typical pessimistic view is, you know, the total surveillance economy, companies that are selling everybody's data, governments installing backdoors into consumer software and devices, social media algorithms that manipulate what stories and ideas we are even exposed to, what communities we even get, you know, an inroad to. But when you start looking at all the negatives or the pushback in today's like new environment, you also have to stop. You have to walk it back and compare. Think about the world in 1988. We're talking about barely a handful of channels on TV. Word of mouth is literally the only real alternative information channel for the vast majority of people. I would say our current cultural and political unrest is actually a consequence of losing that unified story. And that's despite the algorithms, the malware, the surveillance, and the increasing controls working ever harder to prevent it. Still, we have access to alternatives. Still, we have a thriving and well-connected global Bitcoin community that could never be sustained in the world of 1988. I wouldn't know any of the people that I know on Twitter and that I have now met at conferences and stuff. Like, how would I have been connected to those people who are all around the world? Like, I've chatted with, it's hilarious. Every time, like, I try to get an interview together with some of these people, it's like, okay, well, what time zone are you in? It's like, okay, well, I'm 7 hours behind you or 6 hours ahead of you because I'm in Denmark or San Francisco or Hong Kong or something. Like I've spoken to people all around the world, and it feels like we're all in this like one little group online. And it is specifically because, I mean, think about it, Twitter, Facebook, Reddit, all of these things, regardless of how much they may appear to manipulate what we see or who we talk to, they did not exist 15 years ago. None of them. YouTube launched in 2005. In 1988, think about what someone would have responded to the idea of a entirely supranational, like just connected to no country whatsoever, journalistic institution that had no real origins, run by volunteers and funded with donations, that reported and exposed the worst crimes of governments existing in direct opposition to every major government in the world, exposing their crimes, the corruption, and of both governments and corporate corporate abuse all across the modern world. To think that such a thing could even exist is just impossible. It's hilariously unthinkable. But now ask yourself how many people have never heard of WikiLeaks. And now think about all that stuff you know about surveillance of the people, the data gathering and the selling and exchanging of data, the crimes of the CIA and the NSA, the huge surveillance programs that for 30 years were all constantly beaten down as conspiracy theory, conspiracy theory, conspiracy theory. And now we have undeniable proof. We have it in their own words how they were doing it. We have PowerPoints that they presented to each other about how good they were at recording everything we do and tapping into everybody's cameras. And like those people were vindicated after 30 years of nothing. This was all because of people like Snowden and almost universally because of WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks published all of this stuff. Think about this. WikiLeaks is the only journalistic institution on the planet that has never had to issue a retraction. Whatever complaint you or someone else has bitching about WikiLeaks, think about that. Nothing they have ever reported, no matter how inconvenient or uncomfortable it was for everyone involved, they have never had to issue a retraction because they have never told a lie. That is unheard of. And they're practically not owned by anyone. They're an independent, hacker-supported, civil rights, human rights activist-supported institution. They're a wiki. They're just independent and out there. And that does not exist without the internet. It does not exist without encryption, without the safe way to essentially get secrets out from these corrupt institutions and these criminal enterprises, and a safe way to leak and maintain anonymity in the process. It is because of exactly what Tim May was talking about that such an institution exists. So we may not have the vision yet, but the balance of power has shifted in a massive way. Those cryptologic tools enabled these things. It enabled the leaking, the distribution of these state crimes, of horrible atrocities that would have otherwise gone unexposed. And do we really think, you also have to remember that, you know, do we think these sorts of crimes or corruption only started happening after the birth of the internet? You know, that's like saying that your spouse only started cheating on you when you finally installed a spy camera and caught them. No, it has always been happening. The difference is now that we have the capacity to catch them in the act and distribute the information in a way that is extremely difficult for them to stop. Just the speed in which it can be duplicated and shared is one of the most powerful tools that the normal population has ever had against government tyranny. Now, China may be one of the best examples, speaking of tyranny, of how it could go wrong. But I think it's very hard to argue that information is more controlled and manipulated today than it was in 1988, just on the sheer case of what we can be exposed to. And on that point, I think Tim was absolutely correct in his predictions, just either overzealous or maybe a little early in his timeline for the missing how long it would take to create a critical piece of that puzzle. There's a really great quote from this that I think is at the heart of the crypto economy and at the heart of what Bitcoin's purpose. And that quote is, two persons may exchange messages, conduct business, and negotiate electronic contracts without ever knowing the true name or legal identity of the other. Interactions over networks will be untraceable, end quote. I would say that before 2009, before Bitcoin, only the first of these was truly possible, that we can exchange messages privately, we can communicate. Conducting business and there were edge cases of, you know, conducting private business, negotiating electronic contracts. Like, it was certainly more enabled, but never in a scalable way. Never to the tunes of billions of dollars. Never like the Silk Road or the darknet markets. And the Bitcoin and Lightning protocol stack is really what is finally empowering this idea, this dream, to become a reality. We finally have those tools. We have all the tools that I think we need. And there's still plenty of work to be done, but what I mean is practically none of it is still at the theoretical stage. It is all either in development or being implemented as I record this. And I also sort of love that the excuses were no different either, like the pushback when he talks about, it just shows that people don't really change. Really only our technology and environment change, and through that, we change our behavior and we alter our values, but it's because the environment restricts what we're able to do. I highly recommend The Sovereign Individual, and I'll get into that in a second because there's a great analogy that I love in that book. But like the national security, like the pushback for why these cryptographic tools are terrible, right? The internet's terrible is It says national security. I mean, terrorists. And he doesn't say terrorists because that wasn't really the thing back then, but that's exactly what that is. It's the same excuse. If you look up national security, I'm sure terrorism comes in the thesaurus. Drug dealers, tax evaders, and social pariahs, the disintegration of a social discourse. These are all the excuses that the paranoid and controlling powers that be will use to fight against or prevent the technology's dissemination. And it's the exact same story it was with the internet. It's the same story with Bitcoin. And it's going to be the same story with the next thing. So okay. One thing I wanted to bring up is because this usually scares it makes people really uncomfortable. And I love that Tim May puts in this because it's important for people to realize what they think of as uncomfortable in freedom, giving other people freedom. And so I want to talk about assassination markets because he brings them up here and they are a fascinating wild card to the concept of crypto anarchy or the crypto economy, which Tim May calls the crypto net in this piece. I don't like that. I think crypto economy is better. Tim May sucks. The first thing to remember, though, is everyone who has a minor freak out when they hear something that sounds that crazy is that the crypto net or crypto economy in this instance would not be inventing assassination markets. They potentially could open them up to a less centralized, a more out there, just dark net style market. Now, I'm not so certain that this will be as prevalent as some of the, there are a handful of even Bitcoiners and crypto anarchists out there who really think assassination markets will be a big thing. And maybe, I'm not 100% certain, and I'll kind of explain why, but this is definitely a possibility and it cannot be discounted. But the first thing you have to remember, because it sounds so crazy, is assassination markets today are alive and well. Murder is big business in our current world. So when we talk about crypto anarchy and a market for something something that sounds that evil, you have to remember what we're comparing it to. What we have now is something that is limited to the extremes. We have the below grade markets like gangs and drug cartels, and then the above grade markets, the ones that are in the authorities and the political systems like governments, corrupt corporations that are in hand with governments, military manufacturers, these sorts of things. Governments are by no means unfamiliar to assassination markets. They are the ones running those markets right now. They are the vendors and the buyers. In fact, it's probably even more common that what you may think of at first, just on the surface when I mention that, when I just say governments are in the job of assassination. Yes, I'm talking about when political opponents are assassinated. Yes, I'm talking about when journalists, whistleblowers, investigators, witnesses die mysteriously and often very conveniently for people in power or politically dangerous spots. Undoubtedly, some of these supposed assassinations are exaggerations or just insanely coincidental. But just by sheer probability and the convenience of so many of these stories relating to people in powerful political positions, you cannot explain them all by mere coincidence. It happens, and it would be stupid to suggest that it doesn't. We're talking about an entire industry that an entire subset of society in the government and political space that deals with decisions that kill people all the time. They do get desensitized to it. There are recorded conversations where people casually talk about, okay, well, a couple thousand people will die in this instance. It is not at all the stretch to think that they're going to care about one human life that stands in the way of what they think of as the more important goal, the greater good. They've already taken it out of their minds. They make decisions all the time. That's why political authority is such a disgusting and dangerous thing, is because it makes them think that it makes them devalue human life. But let's leave all that aside for now. just go at some time, just go look up false flag on the internet. Do like a Google search or maybe a DuckDuckGo search. That might give you a little bit better results. We're talking about historical attacks. And these are, don't bother going into conspiracy theory ones. There is a absolute, just long list of plenty of verified and like actual proposals, some sent to presidents, and where they literally kill innocent people to create political pressure to start a war. Think about that. That's a special kind of murder market right there. That one has no direct victim in mind outside of the fact that they just have to be explicitly innocent, because killing someone who has earned it defeats the entire goal of such an attack. And this in order to pressure for hundreds of thousands of additional killings. Governments are in the business of war, and they love that business. They play that business day in and day out for decades and decades on end, and they don't stop. They do it because it's worth trillions and trillions of dollars, and they do it because they're good at it. And they're allowed to do it. They get away with it. And what other power is there for influence over the world than just going and, I mean, just look at the CIA. Look at the CIA. It's murky and absurd history. The number of foreign manipulation of elections. It's so funny. Everybody like talks about Trump and Hillary, and they get like screaming about this nonsense, which dumbass are we going to have in office argument, when, you know, at the same time it comes out that the CIA has completely manipulated and had a huge, huge impact on a French presidential election, and it's just like nothing. It's just crickets all across the board. Nobody gives two shits about actual election manipulation. Nobody gives two shits about actual foreign involvement or corruption or manipulation. What they care about is that their candidate didn't win, that their dumbass didn't get to sit in the seat. And that's what's so absolutely, that's why it's so relieving to be able to step away from that. Because when you invest in Bitcoin, when you defund yourself from that money, you are no longer pushing us toward that future. You are no longer funding that world. And I think that's not just a smart decision, it's also a moral obligation in some sense. But we'll step back from that. It's a little too far right now. That institution has done, the history of that institution is hilariously absurd. The purposeful and orchestrated spreading of disinformation, back in 1988, when they're basically feeding information, falsified information, to the major news networks. I can't remember what the name of this. It's a full operation. Details have been completely dropped. And I love how like this comes out in history and they're like, oh, that sucks for the people in the 80s and 90s. Glad we don't have that problem today. And it's like, are you stupid? Are you stupid? We just don't know what they're doing today. But they're 10 times as involved now as they were then because they got away with it. Nobody got punished for that. We know it. We have all the evidence. We have the proof. We know that happened and no one got punished for it. Why would they stop? Why would they stop? It's been paying off massively for decades, arguably for 100 years since the CIA was created. Well, not 100 years, like 70 or something. Was it 1950? I don't know, something like that. Anyway, that institution is riddled with foreign and domestic assassinations through its history. One that's so intertwined and murky that it's difficult to pin these things down. And some things that you think, oh, this is absolutely so absurd, it has to be false. But then you find out that something more absurd was actually totally true, and you can't help but wonder, you know, that maybe there just wasn't enough evidence for that other absurd thing that I discounted at first. And understand, if there are incentives to create assassination markets for a market and a profit for murder, if there is still that pressure, I mean, that desire exists. It does. It's a part of the world, and it's a huge and terrible market right now. So if something like assassination markets turns out to happen in a free market in a crypto-anarchist society, well then, you know, they already exist in places where power is so imbalanced that people are already getting away with it to an insane degree. So if the dynamics, if the power dynamics of encryption simply flips it on its head and rebalances that power difference between those two, then that is still a vastly preferable option to the alternative. That's at least giving the woman who was raped by Clinton and never got her justice, she at least has a different set of options on her side of the table outside of simply accepting the fact that Bill's just going to completely get away with it and she has no option whatsoever and just has to be scared to death for the rest of her life. You should listen to the Michael Malice episode where he interviews her and she tells that full story. Absolutely insane. Absolutely insane. Now look at the sexual assault, the allegations of rape and stuff that have come out of Hollywood in the past couple of years. Remember, these crimes have been going on for ages, where powerful people were raping and taking advantage of young actors and actresses, or anyone who wanted to be successful in the business, and basically said, well, we're going to do this, or I'll make sure you'll never get a job in Hollywood. Think about how totally messed up that is. I cannot come up with one decent excuse why such a thing would be prevalent in Hollywood with arguably very similar power dynamics, but that such a thing would not be prevalent in politics, which we know it is. We know it's anybody who's not just got straight giant blinders on and, you know, is gluing their face to a CNN or something knows that there is something up, that the story and the facade that we see is mostly bullshit. I mean, do I even have to bring up Jeffrey Epstein, you know, Anthony Weiner, the insane amount of history connected to the Kennedys? Social and political power enables people to get away with some very messed up shit. And upsetting those power dynamics, regardless of whether it ends up evolving into the creation of some darknet assassination markets, which again, we actually technically already had that on the Silk Road. There was two supposed vendors offering their services to kill somebody. So we at least have some sort of precursor to what could potentially be some sort of a market like that, except laughably and so painfully ironically, the main vendor, possibly both of them, were Carl Force, the corrupt police officer who was extorting and stealing from tons of the different vendors and buyers on the market for millions of dollars, pocketing the money, not telling anybody, and had access to the Silk Road admin account, and allegedly, which this is where all of the ridiculous claims that Ross Ulbricht tried to murder someone or tried to have a hit put out on someone, that Carl Force may have very well, he had access to the account and quite possibly had a conversation with himself to pin Ross Ulbricht for murder. So you can't discount the comedy in the fact that the only semblance of an assassination market that has ever existed on the darknet was actually the government. It was the government incentive, the government power dynamic, and it was a corrupt officer extorting and stealing money from millions of dollars worth of Bitcoin from people. But again, no matter how you look at it, people aren't different. People aren't suddenly going to change. So when you consider that assassination markets could exist in a crypto-anarchist society, and very possibly, very likely will, remember that it only means it's changed the market. And no matter which way you look at it, it's a fascinating thing to, a dark but fascinating thing to even brainstorm on as to what kind of incentives it creates for people in power for what it even means as a consequence of political power if such a market is actually enabled. So really weird and fascinating place to go. But I think it's also a almost a proof of concept, I guess you could say. It would be a proof of exactly what Tim May says this is that this is in fact a revolution. This is to the printing press what the spread of information was, as the printing press is to the spread of information, and the hegemony of like medieval guilds and the social power structure of the day. Like, we have like encryption and Bitcoin are that to the political and monetary monoliths of our day. The technology is a monetary technology, but the impact it will have, the revolution it is starting, is absolutely a social, economic, and political one. And it will tear down and rebuild our ideas of social, economic, and political power. And there's an amazing analogy used in, this is what I was mentioning earlier in The Sovereign Individual, for explaining exactly why cyberspace will be a different environment when it comes to political and violent control of populations. The authors use the analogy of the oceans. No single country or power has ever truly dominated the ocean. Bodies of water just do not have that capacity for control like exists on land. You can't just make a fence surrounding a section of the ocean. Go back to Carr Campit's awesome piece we did really early in the show, Bitcoin, the Blockade Runner. I'll try to remember to put it in the show notes. To give an example of why, even with the most powerful and largest military force in the world, someone can always squeeze through. So international waters has always basically been a giant stateless zone for all of history because the nature of the environment makes it too fluid, pardon the pun, I guess, to have any concrete authority or say over, like, there's no defined boundaries or borders that make any sense, and nothing that can be surrounded by barbed wire to control the herd. You know, there's no permanent locations of any population. Everything is constantly in motion. The area itself is too vast, and the technology to attempt to control it too insufficient for taming it. And because of this, there's simply never been established any true monopoly power when it comes to the oceans, even today. Those characteristics are shared in cyberspace. There are no borders or boundaries. We can only attempt to artificially reinstall them, but something always leaks through. There are no virtual walls solid enough to keep information contained. There are no real locations of anyone on the internet, on the network. I can connect from the US just as easily as I can connect from Hong Kong, Russia, Brazil, Europe, wherever. I have a VPN specifically for that purpose, so I can choose which jurisdiction I explore the internet from. And I do it explicitly for, this is the one thing everybody talks about, is like, oh, use a VPN and you can BitTorrent, and you know, use a VPN and you can be private from your ISP and all this great stuff, and those are great uses for it. But one of my favorite things to do, and things I value more than anything else, is explicitly defined information that is not curated toward who the major internet conglomerates think that I am. So I've mentioned before that one of the most incredible things to do with a VPN and to understand, to kind of get a glimpse of how Google and the search engines, the advertising companies, the social networks, etc., how they can control or influence your experience on the internet, is to just use a VPN. Search the same thing in Google, but connect to a different country. You will not get the same results. It is always very sobering, especially when you start. It's so easy, particularly in the social media circles, you get in these echo chambers, you start seeing yourself. You try to step back, and you're like, you realize just how narrow a view of the world that you're witnessing. And you have to catch yourself, because when the whole world starts to make a little too much sense and be a little too consistent is, and everything seems to align with what you think in your echo chamber, that's usually curation. Because even the things that, even the truth does not always, even if you believe something that's accurate, the world will never always align with that. It's like the drunkard's walk. The concept where there may be a road, but the drunkard is always taking random steps to left or the right. They just never quite fall off the road, so you have no idea which way it's taking, or which way he's taking at any one point. So it's never going to perfectly align, but the end result of the entire list of random, seemingly psychotic movements still lead down the path of the road. So when everything seems to align too much with what you believe, leave Twitter. Leave your social media circle, whatever it is. And just like you're closing your eyes and, you know, you spin the globe and you just stick a pin in it. Just connect to a completely different place in the world and just kind of go exploring for a little while. It's a very interesting experience. The internet is one of those, like cyberspace in general is one of those things that I think people are, their environments are so curated now. Their entries into this space are so curated that they don't leave their little circle of the internet often. It's very fun to do that. I highly recommend the experience. Plus, just in the last year or so, translations have improved markedly. It's a really crazy how much more coherent the translations are from just a few years ago when you're going to like a Chinese website or something. And that's a powerful technology that just tears apart borders and barriers across all sorts. I mean, consider that I can jump on the internet and read news reports of our current political situation from China. Now, I can't make the least bit of sense out of Chinese, but the technology of the digital age has destroyed that barrier in an incredible way. And with only minor workarounds, we basically can go anywhere we want on the internet. Cyberspace truly has no borders. And interestingly, in this vision that Tim May was seeing for the world, for the crypto-anarchist future that we had, up until very recently, money was, for practical purposes, the only information on the internet that still had borders. The government couldn't stop me from having a conversation with somebody in China or Iran or wherever, but they did have the ability to prevent me getting money there and doing business with them. But that's not the case anymore. And that is not insignificant. Bitcoin is tearing down the last and most important borders in the information age. And in a number of ways, this piece encompasses so much of what this entire project is about, the Crypto Economy Project. There really is a new world with new rules, new money, new communities, and an entirely new structure and a power dynamic, a flat playing field where the rules are ubiquitous. The rules are truly universal and equal. There is still social hierarchy, but there is no monetary hierarchy. The social hierarchy no longer has monetary power. And there is a powerful case to be made that there will not be political power, that social hierarchy will not create that will neuter the political power of that social hierarchy, because the political power is so then dependent on the monetary power. Money is at the heart of so much of what causes the imbalance of human rights in the world. And so that's why I'm here doing the Crypto Economy Podcast. I think we are entering a new world. I think we do have the ability to exit that world now, in a way, in many ways. And I think that exit is only getting more open. The door is getting wider and is going to accept and enable more people to walk away from corrupt governments to pull their labor and their time and their lives away from funding this version of the world that they don't agree with. And I think that's what Bitcoin does. It allows me to live life where I am absent from, like, somebody just tweeted out, I can't even remember who it was. It's some conservative lady or something. But she talked about, I'm not watching this season of America, or I stopped watching this season of America. And it's just so funny. I think Cameron mentioned or responded about it, just talking about how what a relief it is to be able to step back and not care about any of that stuff. Just to realize what a joke it is. I mean, imagine having the stress of thinking that you had to choose between Trump and Hillary, Tweedledee and Tweedledum, corrupt psycho and corrupt idiot. You know, like, just, I mean, think about how stupid it is that we have a system where those are the cream of the crop. That's top choice number one and top choice number two, and we got to figure out which one's one and which one's two. What a f***ing joke. And that these people are going to be able to command trillions of dollars in society? That they're literally going to be able to command the resources that determine the livelihoods of hundreds of millions of people? The fact that anyone has any respect for that system almost blows my mind. Like, there are a lot of stupid people in the world, but it's hard to believe that I ever bought into that storyline. And I don't want anything to do with it. I don't want its money. I don't want its economy. I don't want anything to do with it. Any possible way that I can figure out how to escape and step away and not have to care about that, that I am detached from the consequences of those idiotic decisions that those people make, the better we are as a society, and the better and the more comfortable I am as a human being. Anyone who is waiting on those fucking retards to fix the problems of the world, good luck. You are going to be waiting for a long time. Or you can exit. You can walk away. You can dip your toes in the crypto economy and look at an alternative world. You can fund. You can put your labor. You can put your life. You can put your time and effort toward creating a world of privacy, creating a world where people are actually equal. And, you know, you might not have an option. It's funny, like, these tools, if there's a dedicated group of people building it, it may be the inevitable future. And I tend to agree that that's where we are. And I think Tim May saw the future that was possible, and I think he saw where we were headed. And out of those two options, out of the China, out of the future that America is headed toward, that's no future for me. I can't be there. I can't be a sheep. I can't just buy into all of their bullshit and just do what they're told and wear their thing around my neck that tells them when I'm taking a dump and how long I'm talking to somebody else. I can't do that. I don't want to be a part of it. And I hope you don't either. And that's why I think this is the most important technology we could possibly be spending our time on, that we could possibly be investing in. And That's why this project exists and why I do it every day. So it could quite possibly be the most important decision we ever make. And when you're living in a time where the world is changing faster than it ever has in history, which direction are you pushing that change? Which future? We have two futures. We have the social credit system, and we have the Bitcoin and the crypto economy. Which future are you pushing us toward? We should ask ourselves that every day. And with that, we will close it out. Thank you guys for listening to this, to episode, to quick read 300. Really insane to have made it this far. Thank you guys so, so much for listening. If you want to support this show, you can always, if you want to donate to help, I've got Bitcoin donation address, Lightning address, or Lightning tipping jar. And Obviously, you can also become a Patreon or a patron at Patreon and help to turn all of these great pieces into audio and help expand on these ideas and principles. Help me to educate other people about them and at least get them to begin to see or imagine that the world could actually be different, that we could actually have a different path for the future, and what we can all do to help be a part of that path. So this is The Crypto Economy. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. Don't forget to subscribe to the show. I'll have the link so that you can check out activism.net. There's actually a lot of kind of crypto anarchist rabbit hole to go down. There's a whole page about the cypherpunks. So there's plenty of other stuff to read and dig into if you want to. There's really fun stuff up there, so I encourage it. But I'll have the link to the original post in the show notes and a couple of the other things I mentioned in the show or in the commentary here. So thank you again, and I will catch you all next time on the Crypto Economy Podcast. Until then, take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.